Welcome to Geographers Without Borders, brought to you by Women in GIS. This interview-style podcast brings you guests from around the world to share about their niche in geography. From GIS to urban planning to marine biology, scientists and professionals around the world use the science of geography to solve problems critical to humanity every day. Stick around for the end of the episode to find out more about getting involved in Women in GIS. And now your host, Shannon Fox Day.
Welcome back to Geographers Without Borders. On today's episode, we are talking to Dawn Wright, who is currently the chief scientist of ESRI. Dawn has done some incredible things in her career, and today we're going to talk about how she decided she would go for the position at ESRI, what it's like to work with Jack Dangermond, and whether she thinks GIS is a career or a tool. Join us now for the interview. Dawn, welcome to Geographers Without Borders. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be with you, Shannon. Thank you.
So how did you decide that you wanted to pursue a degree in geology when you were young?
Well, I started off at age 8 wanting to be an oceanographer. And this was because of my childhood growing up in Hawaii and being in the ocean just about every day and being fascinated with the ocean and also with volcanoes, because all of the Hawaiian islands are basically volcanoes that started on the ocean floor and worked their way up to the surface. And I was really fascinated by that. So I did some research in the library with actual books, because I'm so old that my childhood was before the internet as we know it today. And I had to go to an actual library and sit down with some actual books and do some reading. And I discovered at that time that in order to become an oceanographer, you needed to major in one of the four basic sciences. Most people think of marine biology and that part of oceanography, but oceanography is actually marine biology, marine chemistry, marine physics, and marine geology. And I chose marine geology and found out that in order to pursue that path, I needed to start first with a basic degree in geology. And then from there, you go to graduate school to specialize. So that's how things started off for me.
Did you feel at all like that was too imposing of a hill to climb when you were young and just starting out?
No, I think it's with any field, if you're interested in it, if you're passionate about it, if you can actually see yourself being in that field, and that includes also with GIS and with mapping, it's just a matter of following the path that will lead you to an opportunity to actually become a professional blank, professional geologist, professional oceanographer, professional cartographer, GIS specialist, and so forth. So no, school was also very, very fun for me. I had a series of really outstanding teachers in elementary and middle school who made us all feel great about our talents and about our interests and really got us excited, especially about science. So it was really a positive pathway for me.
Very cool. That is awesome, especially having older people and adults encourage you to learn more about something that you're passionate about already.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Do you think, looking where you are now and looking back to young Dawn, did you ever think you would end up doing something even remotely similar to what you're doing now?
Well, I never, ever in my wildest imagination thought I would end up as chief scientist of ESRI, but that's another story. But I very much had in mind going to sea on ships and working with rocks and having adventures and even working with maps. So even though there were some challenges and bumps along the way, that really panned out very nicely. I think it really starts with seeing that this can all be possible when you're in college and beyond that, graduate school. And all of those were overall mostly positive experiences for me. So it was not a problem to actually see myself in these roles.
That's awesome. Speaking of Esri, when that position came up, how did you know that you wanted to go for that? Or how did that kind of play out?
Yeah, that's a really interesting story because it was not an advertised position. It was more of a strategic decision that Jack Dangerman and Scott Morehouse, who was the director of software development at that time, they made the decision to recreate the position of chief scientist in a different way. Esri did have an initial chief scientist who was David McGuire, a very, very distinguished GI scientist. I believe at the time he was involved in international business development at Esri. And I believe he saw a need for more strategic internal research and development at Esri and created the position of chief scientist at that time. I believe this was in the 90s and 2000s. But after he left Esri, the position was dormant. It did not exist anymore. And Jack and Scott decided to bring it back to Esri, but in a different way, and to bring in a person who was more of a domain, what we call a domain scientist, someone who is in a natural scientific field such as oceanography or geology or conservation biology, and someone who could bridge the gap between what Esri is creating or was creating at the time and the scientific community. So the difference there was to have someone someone who certainly could do the science behind GIS, the geographic information science, but actually have more of a cultural tie to the other sciences, the sciences that Esri builds application tools for. And I'm not sure of all of the decision-making that went into it, but the next step was that I received a message from Scott and from Jack asking me to consider this new role at Esri. So it wasn't something that was advertised. It was something where they basically, I think part of it was that Jack was tired of receiving all of these letters from me about how poorly Esri software was performing for oceanographic science and how Esri could do so much better there. And so I was given the opportunity to really come to Esri and to be a part of that and a part of many, many other things. So it was really a wonderful, for me, I think of it as being in the right place at the right time. I was also just about to go on sabbatical from my faculty post at Oregon State University and to take a year to do something different. And so the way that we fashioned this was from my end, I started off in the Esri chief scientist role as part of a special 2-year sabbatical from Oregon State. And my intention was to return to Oregon State after 2 years. That was not Jack's intention. Jack pretty much assumed that once I moved down to Redlands and started to begin this new work of reinvigorating and creating a chief scientist, a new chief scientist role and a new program that serves the broader scientific community, that was just going to be my life's work. And he turned out to be correct. So I've comes the revolution now. I've been at Esri for 11 years in this role, and it's been super, super challenging, but super exciting.
I am sure. So what you're saying is we should continue to submit error reports to Esri.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's why we have Esri Ideas. That's why we have technical support. This was, and what I was talking about to Jack was certainly the technical challenges, but also the broader mission of Esri and culture of Esri to evolve to the point where scientists are considered and the needs of scientists and how they use Esri software, which often pushes the boundaries of what Esri software can do, to pay attention to that community and to pivot in order to listen and evolve the software to serve that community as well, in addition to state and local government and utilities and energy and the other traditional customers of Esri. So that was a really neat thing to be involved in. And there's always, we are always going to have challenges, things that we need to improve in our software, but also in our services. And so that's why when you get hired at Esri, Jack's assumption is that you are making this your life's work, because it takes that type of commitment and that type of effort to evolve Esri as a company and to keep us moving forward.
When it comes to your career, what would you say was the scariest step that you have taken in that journey? Was it taking the position of chief scientist? Was it not returning to Oregon State? Or was it getting into a fully submersible mechanical thing and going to the deepest part of the ocean?
Well, I would say that the scariest step for me was indeed to decide to step away from Oregon State, even for the 2-year sabbatical. Normally professors are away for just 1 year, but and I had a lot of support from my dean and my department chair at Oregon State at the time to negotiate this special arrangement where none of us on our side, on the Oregon State or on my side, knew how that was going to turn out. But that was a risk and a step for me that was to date the scariest. And part of that was moving away from Oregon to Southern California to live here in Redlands, where Esri's headquarters are. And also to realize that if I decided to keep going in this particular role, that something was going to have to give. I couldn't have two full-time jobs for sure. And I was going to have to make a choice between continuing with Esri full-time or going back to Oregon State and continuing with them full-time. So this whole thing forced me actually to make the decision to stay with Esri, which meant that the Oregon State part had to change. I'm still with Oregon State, but I'm no longer full-time with them. And most importantly, for a lot of academics, I had to give up my tenure at that university. I had to give up my lab. And I did have around 6 or 7 graduate students who still needed to be shepherded through to the completion of their degrees. So I had to complete that process. So all of that was a real risk. It was very scary, but I would not change any part of it. But especially for college professors, once you get a guaranteed job, which is what tenure is, which means that unless you do something completely off the wall or unethical or breach the code of good conduct of a university community member, you are guaranteed a job, and you are given the freedom to continue to to grow and to move into different research and teaching modes. The university and the state has made a lifelong pact with you as a member of the academic community and as an employee, really, of their state government, that you, that they are investing in you for the rest of your career. And that's what tenure means to me, because there are a lot of discussions now about what university tenure or academic tenure means, what it should mean, and whether or not it matters anymore. I say that it does matter in that sense. And so to give that up was a huge decision, very scary, very risky, but thankfully it turned out to work out for me.
Wow, that must have been such a big decision to make in life when you're faced with something like that. The moving geographically, obviously, different state, different place. It's, you know, huge. And like you said, giving up tenure is definitely a big thing.
Just to add on to that, too, this was my situation, but I think for a lot of us, for your listeners, especially for those who are women, and they have made certain decisions and certain pathways, and given the obstructions that are in our way, the way of women anyway, there are a lot of situations where making a decision can not only be life changing, but it can be extremely scary, and it can be extremely risky. And things can go the other way. So I was very, very lucky to have good mentorship on both on the side of Oregon State. I had the support of my mother, my primary family. I'm an only child, so my primary family was my mother. And then on the other side with Esri, I had the unwavering support and confidence of Jack Dangerman himself, who really believed in this position, believed in what I was trying to do, supported me every step of the way, even though that support was not the same throughout the company. It really helped to, of course, have his support. It's his company. So for all of us who are making these kinds of decisions, it really does help to know which way to go if you've got a really good support system around you to help with those types of steps.
Absolutely. And having someone like Jack, a head of the company, kind of empowering you into that role and the support is critical. And on the family side too, that's just really critical and incredible. For young people today, what is a risk that you would advise them to take, or maybe a risk that would be a red flag that they should avoid?
Well, for young people today, the big elephant in the room, I think, is still COVID. And the young people are making a big decision as to whether or not to even go to college. Yes. That was a given for so many of us for so many years. But the pandemic has thrown everything on its head. And the college experience has not been the same. With the inability of students to be on campus with professors, there's been the rise of distance education, which is a two-edged sword, I believe. There are so many good experiences that one can have at a distance, remotely, through distance education, but it can also go completely the other way. And we've seen this with the struggles that many children have had with learning during the pandemic. So that is, I would say that's a risk, whether or not you're going to go to college or go to graduate school. I think it takes a lot of careful research and planning in terms of which school you're going to go to, which schools have been able to weather the storm of the pandemic and to change and evolve to the state where they can still deliver a good educational experience given the state that our world is in and the uncertainties of our world. And then there's always I think there are always risks whenever you try to do something that is that takes you completely out of your comfort zone. I would say not to never think that just because something makes you uncomfortable, like maybe taking on a different type of project that you're not sure if you have the background and skills for, or another situation where you're going to another country, to another culture. Those can be very rich and very positive and very transformative experiences. So I wouldn't be able to say what would be a red flag to avoid, but just to I guess the red flag is to avoid, I would say, is fear. Fear that you can't do it, that because people might be telling you not to do it, that you should just give up and try something else. Fear, I guess what I'm trying to say is that fear is a red flag because it's counterintuitive, but given how complex and uncertain and crazy our world is, there's still we can't have that kind of fear. That does not help us. And I would say in GIS, we need to not be fearful. We need to not be fearful of new technology. We need to not be fearful of, for instance, AI. There's so many things that are happening in the GIS world to make sure that we are working towards a more equitable, a powerful but also a fair and just type of technology, whether it be hardware or software. So there are just so many exciting ways to go. So don't be afraid.
I totally agree. I think when you hear young people talking about they can't try this or they can't try that, sometimes I just want to grab them and say, "No, you can. There's different paths for everyone." And I agree. Don't be afraid. Try it out. And it's okay if it maybe doesn't work the way you thought it did the first time.
And if it doesn't work, there are, as you say, so many other pathways. There's so many needs out there, and so many parts of the GIS and the geography world that there is certainly something for everyone.
You mentioned AI a little bit. How do you think, and I'm assuming that you're familiar with chatbot GPT that's taken us all by storm by now. How do you think AI like chatbot GPT could affect professions like GIS?
Well, it's very interesting because these types of new open AI products, I think it's OpenAI that's put out Chat GPT and DALL-E and similar tools that are indeed taking the world by storm. One thing I've noticed about them, so for instance, GPT stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer. So there's still a lot of work. These are not fully formed, fully mature technologies, just as GIS was not a fully formed, fully mature technology in the 1960s and 70s. And look where it is now, and how much good it's doing. So I would say, first of all, that we still need a lot of time to evaluate and to work with these technologies before we make a final judgment on them, on whether they can contribute. There are many dangers that are being seen in many of these tools, and that's the good thing about all of the not only people are trying out these tools, but there's a ton of research, evaluative research that's going on to see how to improve these tools. In fact, there are several AI projects that Google, for instance, is undertaking that they are not releasing yet because they want to make sure that they can be used in the best possible way. Another thing about tools such as Chat GPT and DALL-E is that these are natural language tools. they take your speech or your text and they learn from that and then produce a term paper or a report or a painting, an image accordingly. GIS is, I would say, is different because GIS is based on the language of maps, the language of space and time. And that, I would say, is a different type of natural language. In fact, I wouldn't even call it a natural language. We deal with latitude, longitude, depth, elevation, and all of those coordinates and components that make up a visual map or a mental map. And that's a different type of language. That's why there is the expression that Professor Luke Anselin at the University of Chicago coined many decades ago, spatial is special. That spatial language is different. And I don't think that these AI tools are dealing in that realm yet. ChatGPT is not a GIS. Mm-hmm. DALL-E is not an image processing system. That's different. So there are certainly ways that these are going to affect everybody in whatever sector we're in. But in terms of it taking over or providing, posing a threat to GIS, I don't see that happening right now.
I would agree with that. It's so early to tell, and I'm interested to see where it goes myself. But I don't think that I don't think there's necessarily a call for alarm. Maybe yet.
Yes, and the types of AI that is used in GIS, in the various types of machine learning and deep learning that we provide or that people are developing for GIS algorithms, that is, I think, is moving along well, although they're, for instance, if you look at the research of Renee Sieber, she is constantly, she's a Canadian scholar and does a fantastic job of making sure that the scientific and the computer science community is aware of dangers that lie in AI. Certainly there can be misrepresentation and error that's associated with some of these algorithms. And then especially where people are involved, where how certain geographic spaces are characterized or judged depending on who lives there. Mm-hmm. That's where we get into the dangers of perpetuating redlining or gerrymandering or some of these are the dark sides of GIS, as I call them, where maps are used for nefarious or for purposes that divide and make people unequal. So we certainly need, there's a lot of research going on there to make sure that we keep that in check or eradicate that as much as possible from geo AI.
Yes, real concerns and things that we need to stay abreast of, absolutely. Would you say that GIS is, in your opinion, a career or a tool?
Oh, I would say it's both. A long time ago, I wrote a paper with Michael Goodchild and James Proctor that was entitled GIS Tool or Science. And at that time, we were making the case, and that was in the early 90s, when this idea of GIS as a science rather than just a software package was taking hold. And the community was developing a theory behind GIS, such as Tobler's first law of geography, thinking about space and place and proximity and how things are related to each other. The ideas and the concepts that underlie what we actually write the software code to do. And so that has, I think, laid the foundation for careers in GIS. GIS has become an ubiquitous technology. It's everywhere. It's when we think about where Esri technology is, that's mind-boggling. But Esri is in everything. There are all kinds of there are other companies. What GIS is now is something that is really part of our daily lives. Getting our packages from Amazon is one fantastic example, because of, or figuring out what alternate roads to take if there's a traffic jam. That's all GIS. It's in all of these technologies. But the science behind that is now a legitimate science, with degrees, certificate programs, books, journals, departments that are just in that area, which also allows people to prepare themselves or get involved in careers. So the GIS is a tool. It's ArcGIS. I was going to say ArcInfo because I started in the 90s. it is QGIS. Those are the tools. But then there are all of the wonderful people who are in Women in GIS, for instance, and all the communities of practice there. That's the career.
Yep. I think that that's a great way to put it. I agree. They're intertwined in such a way that I don't think you can really separate them too much. And as you say, it's everywhere. It's really in our phones, it's in our computers, it's all over. We're using maps all the time. What do you think, or what would you say is the next big thing in GIS?
Well, the AI is going to be with us for some time, and leveraging AI to really be smart, you know, artificial intelligence instead of artificial stupidity, as some people joke, because there's so many dangers to AI that leveraging that in a good way, I think, will be one of the next major. It's one of the next big things for all of these different fields, including GIS, and so much of AI now has people thinking in three dimensions and wanting to see things in virtual reality, the metaverse. That's something that is with us, whether we want to acknowledge that or not. And Facebook especially is putting, well, they are not Facebook anymore, are they? They are Meta. And Facebook is just the app, one of the apps. So the virtual reality, augmented reality part of GIS has been super exciting for a long time now, and there is so much that is being developed, and I think that continues to be the next big thing, especially with regard to so for instance, there are the urban environments, the virtual reality part that goes into games, geo gaming. These are the areas, artificial worlds, or not even artificial worlds, but natural worlds that are recreated in the computer, which is part of the exciting work that we do at Esri in terms of terrains on land and 3D digital ocean environments. All of that to me is part of the next big thing.
Yes, bringing, almost making the world bigger, but making it smaller almost. Bringing it to more people who maybe couldn't go there otherwise.
Exactly. Yeah, that's very well stated.
Yeah, that's so fascinating to me. If you could, and this I think is very poignant for you because you've explored so many places. So maybe we open this up to greater than Earth, but if you could explore any place on Earth or other, where would you pick?
That is a really good question. And for me, my mind has been blown by going to the deepest, darkest place on the entire planet, which is Challenger Deep. I am satisfied, sufficiently blown away by that experience that I am actually not looking to outer space. So many people have asked me, is outer space next for you? And that would be awesome. But, you know, I will be really honest with you. The place that is on my bucket list, the place that I would truly love to explore is the LEGO headquarters in Billund, Denmark. That is really where I would like to explore next. I want to go to their design studios. It's sort of the way a lot of people feel about Esri and coming to Esri headquarters. I want to go to the LEGO group headquarters and talk to their designers and their storytellers and see how the toys are made and just really get immersed in that as much of a LEGO fan as I am.
That would be very cool. That's what a terrific answer. That's great. Well, any last bits of advice that you would give to someone who is interested in geospatial profession?
Well, I would say to whoever is listening to this podcast, if you are not already involved in a wonderful group like Women in GIS or Young Professionals Network or any of these communities of practice, career communities, to really get involved, to check them out, join in. And hopefully this podcast series will help those who are not already involved and not already being supported by wonderful organizations like these, like Women in GIS, for instance, to definitely get involved.
I agree. As a member of Women in GIS, I love the group and I love our communities of practice. So thank you so much, Dawn, for coming on and talking with us at Geographers Without Borders. And that's a wrap.
We'd like to thank our sponsors for their continued support. A special thanks to our platinum sponsors, the Wyoming Geographic Information Science Center at the University of Wyoming and Esri. Welcome to Geographers Without Borders, brought to you by Women in GIS. This interview-style podcast brings you guests from around the world to share about their niche in geography. From GIS to urban planning to marine biology, scientists and professionals around the world use the science of geography to solve problems critical to humanity every day. Stick around for the end of the episode to find out more about getting involved in Women in GIS. And now your host, Shannon Foxday.